The following talk was from the Foundation 7 conference at the Quinter Conference Center, April 2016.
She's had to dash off to do a little bit of work in a hospital in Manchester, but she will be back in the afternoon. She's a busy lady. She's quite high up in the surgical profession, so she's an important lady. So we're going to start the talks today. I'm going to start. I suppose I'm the aperitif, the soup. We have the main course, David, and then the dessert, Chris. Now I think we've got two main courses with just a little bit of a starter for me. I wouldn't normally be speaking first. We normally have one of the big powerful, you know, Bible teachers speaking first. But I thought because of the theme of the conference, it's good to actually explain a bit more about what we mean by Hebraic church. And you can't miss it, really, but there are the books there. Hebraic church has been launched today. I've spoken about this before. I was at Brenda Taylor's congregation out in Cornwall, and I sort of introduced this idea, I made a very big statement. I said I reminded them about the Reformation, you know, in the 16th century, Martin Luther with his 95, and this is where I got the word wrong, it should have been theses. Okay, there you go. And I remember doing this at the Tree of Life, and it's very easy. Once you've got a picture in your head, it's very difficult to actually be serious from that point onward. So here is Martin Luther at the door of Wittenberg Cathedral with his 95 theses. those of you who are a bit puzzled, these are his objections to the Catholic Church at the time, the 95 things that they were getting wrong, and this is what sort of ignited the Protestant Reformation. So I suggested that perhaps that Reformation didn't go far enough. There are many ways you can look at it and say, well, it didn't. It certainly didn't address the Jewish situation. It still left us with established churches, with state churches. So it didn't really go far enough. So I just suggested maybe it's time for a new Reformation. And I have 7 theses. And I said, do I have any volunteers? This is what I said, for someone to post these up on St. Paul's Cathedral. And 3 ladies put their hands up. They were serious. I realized that sometimes you say things and, you know, if you're joking, you should make it apparent that you're joking. So no one's putting their hands up here. But seriously, this is sort of the core of the book. The core of the book is saying that I think I've identified, and of course this is just my opinion, that there are sort of 7 areas that sort of separate us from the church of the original church, the church of the way. There are 7 things that they did or were aware of, or that sort of, was a part of what they actually were, that we've sort of lost over 2,000 years. There's sort of 7 sort of major differences. But before that, I thought just to sort of carry on from what I was saying yesterday about Hebraic church is why I picked that title. Well, it was actually given to me in the middle of the night in someone. There's 2 people here, and they may even be in the very bed where I was lying a year ago. I was in the Premier Inn, Oswestry, over a year ago, and the Lord woke me up in the middle of the night and gave me these words, Hebraic church. And then from there, it's taken a year just to sort of think the thing through. We've had we did have a little meeting last June or July. We met up in Scotland and we had people on the phone, and we just sort of thought it through, what is Hebraic church, and we started a document where we sort of defined the key areas that we thought were important, and then people added to the document, and it started off with like 4 pages and ended up with 25 pages, and it's like a Talmud, you know, you have a central sort of point, and then everyone just added points here, there and everywhere. So we do have that document somewhere if you're interested, but it doesn't actually make much sense. But it was an interesting exercise, and it sort of led to the book. And the point being, Hebraic Church, it's a purposefully provocative title, because it's bringing together two elements that normally would not sit together very comfortably. We have those, a lot of people here who would be comfortable with the word Hebraic, because you sort of understand what it means. But that word is like red rag to a bull, to the dog collars, let's say, for the established church, because of historical reasons, because of perhaps prejudice, perhaps of, you know, the lies of the enemy. You know, the word Hebraic just conjures up very, very negative connotations. And it's all about, you know, it's taking us back to the, or we don't like the word Hebrew, anything Jewish. It's just something that's come down through the ages, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed. But on the other hand, there are loads of us, some here, and certainly some have been to other earlier conferences we've had, where the word church is a problem, you know, because of the problems of history. What the church has done in the name of Christ over the years has been quite bad when we look at the Jewish experience, for example. So let's put the two words together, and then it's not something you tend to forget. We could have called ourselves biblical church, but then, you know, it doesn't mean, it's not different enough. Everyone thinks they're biblical, that's the thing. So Hebraic church sort of gives the signal that we recognize the body of Christ in terms of the church, but we want to bring back Hebraic elements. We want to get back to the origins of our faith, the Jewish background. So being Hebraic, I've got a few definitions. Being Hebraic is to enter into the way that Jesus, his disciples, and the Old Testament characters thought and processed their thoughts. Being Hebraic is to act always to please God and not man, to have a sincere desire to know God rather than to know about him, to be thoroughly community-minded rather than a disconnected individual within a community. It's all aspects that tend to have been lost by the established church. And it's to acknowledge that there can be more than one way to crack a nut. And that's another aspect of thinking Hebraically is, you know, the Greek way that we've been brought up to thinking is very, very black and white. And we know that it's the black and white stuff that's caused problems in the church, that you tend to be in this corner or that corner and be out of fellowship over the most ridiculous issues. You know, there's so much infighting that goes on in the church. And yet we are all meant to be brothers and sisters. So that's, and I think that sort of defines very, very roughly what Hebraic is. A lot of my earlier books will talk more about it, and there's more in this, but I won't go too much into it. But what I want to do is to sort of take us back to those times. So we're back to the time of the Book of Acts and Simon and John and James. And you know, how did they think and act that's different to how we think and act? And this is where I got to these sort of seven things. So what I'm going to do is just go through them sort of briefly in a sort of overview, and then see where we end up. They're very, very, five of them are very, very basic and obvious, because it's the big things that have gone wrong. So the first one is God himself, our view of God, you know, and how real is our faith? It's our faith in God that has taken a real battering over the years, and we can trace that back to from the time of Thomas Aquinas, the early Catholic theologian, who basically brought in the idea from Greek philosophy, from Aristotle, that faith itself is not enough. There needs to be reason. We need to not accept God by faith alone, but we have to think him through. And out of that came a lot of apologetics, where, you know, proofs of God, you know, with all these long philosophical sort of constructs, yeah, you know, how to prove God. And that is when too much thinking came in, and you follow history from that point onwards, and you see a real decline in the certainty of faith in God. And our faith started off as being very God-centered, has now ended very man-centered, because our minds have sort of, let's say, been catered for more than our sort of faith muscles. And you can trace that right back from Thomas Aquinas through to the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, and then the rise of liberal Christianity back in the 19th century. And when Darwin came along with the theory of evolution, it's like the Christian world was ready for him. They wanted to believe in these scientific ideas. They had already sort of formulated an idea of God as sort of an absentee landlord. These are the deists that sort of said, well, God just started everything off. You know, it's a very sort of English way of thinking. You know, God just sort of lit the blue touch paper. Everything started at creation, and then he went away and let us do what we like. And that was sort of the unconscious view of God that has sort of come in as a result of these ideas from Greek philosophy. So I got a good example of this. In fact, it's not even in the book. It's something that came out. I was researching something to do with the sort of the remnant church over the ages, and I was looking at John Wycliffe. Now, John Wycliffe was he was called the Morning Star of the Reformation. He was like 200 years before Martin Luther, and he had the simple idea that, you know, he saw the excesses and the heresies of the church, and he said it's about time that people actually had a Bible in their own language. So his big thing was to translate the Bible into English, because unbelievably no one had an English Bible at that time. But the thing is, the church didn't like this, and his biggest enemy was the Archbishop of Canterbury. You know, unbelievably, he said, no, you know, there's no way you could put the Bible into English, because then people would read the Bible and see how far away the church had got from the ideal. So he had a lot of trouble, and he was hounded his whole life. And when he didn't actually die as a martyr, but his bones died as a martyr, because when he died, they dug him up, they dug his bones up and burnt them and threw him into a river. You know, that's how negatively they thought of him. Well, there's one incident historically that sort of makes sense of all this. When I can't remember the exact date, but there was a Church of England synod, and it took place in Blackfriars Priory around that time, and they convened it in order to denounce John Wycliffe and to formulate a list of heresies that John Wycliffe and his followers were responsible for. So here were all the big churchmen all meeting together in this priory, and suddenly there was an earthquake, a major earthquake, and they had to leave the building. And this earthquake affected where they were, but it also affected St. Paul's Cathedral. Bits of St. Paul's started falling away. And most amazingly, Canterbury Cathedral, which was 100 miles away, was also affected. And the crux of this was that the Archbishop said, this is obviously a scientific phenomenon, and we can all put it down to Aristotle. John Wycliffe and his followers say, it's God speaking. and this is how the church had got. God had made a very visible proclamation using good old Testament ways of communicating through the elements, you know. And here was the Archbishop of Canterbury saying, no, it wasn't God. You know, it's just a complete coincidence. Here we are talking about denouncing John Wycliffe, and an earthquake comes along. And it's the same thing as those of you who remember, you know, in the 80s with David Jenkins, the Archbishop of Durham, and the York Minster burning. You know, God communicates still. And the thing is that the church has fallen so far away from a firm understanding of God and his ways that they look for excuses, in natural excuses. It's putting their mind at the forefront, and their faith just takes a back seat. So that's the sort of the first thesis. Well, I don't know what the singular for thesis. Thesis? I don't know. It's the first proclamation to be banged on the door of St. Paul's Cathedral is, how real is your faith? The next thing is going into the areas that are very much very important for, let's say, Hebraic church and a Jewish understanding is, who is your Jesus? It's understanding Jesus from his proper historical context, i.e. the Jewish Jesus. Now, the church is sort of slowly waking up to this. Maybe a generation ago, you couldn't use the word Yeshua at all. No one would know what you were saying. And even the idea of Jesus actually being Jewish would have been a surprise to a lot of churchgoers. But I think today most of the church sort of more or less understands that Jesus was Jewish, it still is Jewish, and that Yeshua is probably a name that he used. Now that's, okay, it's a start. And of course, churches are starting to put on Passovers. That's one little concession that they make, and that's happening more and more. And we have this little booklet that we did called the Easter Telling. We're going to be doing four of them, the Easter Telling, the Christmas Telling, the Harvest Telling, and the Pentecost Telling. And the whole idea is to use titles that the church is familiar with. You know, I've got into trouble from some of our people for using the word Easter and Christmas. But the point is, it's to communicate to those, to pick up the book. Oh, Christmas, I do Christmas. So they'll pick up the book and then they'll open it and it will talk about the Hebraic background, why Christmas is wrong and how we should be celebrating Christmas and Easter and harvest, which should be Sukkot, you know, tabernacles. And of course, Pentecost, which should be Shavuot. So I'm hoping to get the Pentecost one done in time for Pentecost. Though that's going to be difficult because it's only a couple of weeks away. And this, unfortunately, this conference has got in the way. But I'll see if I can get one uploaded onto the website in time for Pentecost. So because it's sort of, I've got the rough plan in my head. I just need to get it down. So anyway, just an understanding of Jesus from his proper Jewish historical context. So the church has lost so much blessing through not understanding the true context of Jesus. The understanding of the festivals, you know, has been lost as a result of, you know, moving away from the Hebrew roots. It's a whole long story, and there's loads of books behind you that explains all that stuff. So that is something that would obviously be no problem for the early church. The early church, they were Jewish. They did the festivals. They still visited the synagogue. They still kept Torah to a certain extent. And there was no problems. It's what happened in the 2,000 years since then that's created the extra problems. So that's the second. So we've got God, we've got Jesus. The third one is the Bible. Just understanding the Bible properly. That understanding that the Bible is God's mouthpiece. It's not just a book on your bookshelf or any other book. It's not a reference book. It's like it's a living. It's sort of the written equivalent of God himself. You know, the words are from God to you. It's not like any other book. But even Christians now would just use it as a book where they would perhaps have their own ideas of things and then look for the Bible to sort of agree with them. You know, this is the way you shouldn't use the Bible. It's called eisegesis. It's where, and that's how a lot of theology comes through to us. People would have a certain lifestyle that they want God to sort of approve of, so they look for verses that seem to agree, and they say, "Thus says the Lord." The idea is that we meant the God that God uses the Bible to speak to us. It's us reading the Bible to hear what God has to say to us, not what we have to say to Him to say to us. You know, so that's been lost into so many ways, and we need to get back to the certainty. And two conferences ago, I made a provocative statement, and it wasn't a real statement. It's, you know, was Jesus gay? Now, the reason why I said that is because there are theologians that, from their own perspective, would comb the scriptures in order to twist them to make you think. And one of them would be looking at John being, you know, Jesus' favorite disciple. One particular theologian took that as far as saying, well, they were in some kind of relationship and would seek to find proof in a lost gospel. It wasn't even a real gospel. But even looking at translating the actual Greek of the New Testament, the word, when it said Jesus loved John, it was the word, I think, philio, rather than eros, you know. So it was brotherly love, not erotic love. So, you know, some people will go to the extreme lengths to read their own thoughts into the Bible, and that is to be avoided. And we need to sort of get the church to have a real understanding. And there are so many issues that are, let's say, borderline issues, but important. And one of them would be Israel. One would be creation. And David has written about creation. Got a book coming out later this year, hopefully, talk to David if you want to help him with his book. And it's sort of similar to my book, The Bishop News New Clothes, but it concentrates more on issues like creation, family, wasn't it? Yeah, got family in there. Yeah, sort of social issues. So it's the idea of getting back to the Bible. And for that, I have to commend the work of Mr. Andrew over there, David Andrew, with Sword magazine. You'll be hearing a lot about Sword at this conference, and it is a magazine that is totally Bible-soaked in the way that we would understand the Bible. So we all need to be getting Sword. I say that because I'm slightly involved, but, you know, David's done a fantastic job over the years. He's just kept going despite many things that haven't been so good. Obviously, Satan obviously doesn't like David bringing out Sword. So, you know, a lot of arrows have been fired over at him, and it's about time we all supported him and really got this thing moving again. So anyway, that's the third thing. So we've got God, Jesus, the Bible. And the fourth one is Israel, the Jewish people. And this is, it's a big one really for the church. Do the Jews still have any divine favour? You know, can we justify all the bad stuff that's been thrown at the Jewish people with the church acting as God's avenger, you know, to sort of carry out God's, you know, plans against the Jews? It all comes out of hate, out of anti-Semitism, out of a misunderstanding of the Bible. And you know, and it's a story that most of us are aware of, but most of the church are still stuck in that rut because it hasn't been explained to them that how important it is that if God makes a covenant with a people, he doesn't just turn against them for no reason at all. If God is going to, let's say, curse the Jews for anything they did wrong in biblical times, can you imagine the curses that the church deserves? You know, if God was going to be consistent, then we are to be utterly rejected, and our salvation is totally, you know, not to be, you know, taken as a given. So we have to realize that God does not break his covenants. And that is something that the church is just so confused about. And that has to be a big issue that we all need to get through to the wider church. It's something that I've even used in the other book, the book Hope is sort of a version of Hebraic church, but more for the general believer and for the unsaved, let's say. It's an evangelistic book. And I was on Premier Radio last week. I don't know, did anyone hear that? On the breakfast show. Yeah, it's all a bit all over the place. So, you know, I had 3 minutes and then there's like 10 minutes of adverts and silly games and then I was back again. You know, but at least they gave me the opportunity. But one thing that John Pantry said to me, which really made me laugh, he said, "Yeah, your books, they're a bit complicated, aren't they?" You know, I said, "My books are purposefully dumbed down." But this is really, it's really important to realise that the average audience of Premier Radio, and apart from any of you here that actually listen to it, the average audience is, you need to dumb down even more, because they want, I do this blog for them twice a week called Yeshua Explored, which is basically just my books, serialising my books. And they're saying that the people that have come to it and enjoying it are those people from all over the world who understand the Hebrew roots and really get into it. But the average Christian going to it, oh, it's all too complicated. It's too many words, you know. So I have to, from May onwards, I'm having to rename it. So it won't be Yeshua Explored anymore. It'll be something like Church Rediscovered. And it's going to be further dumbed down. It's got to be 500 words instead of 800, 900. It's got to have pictures. It's got to have snappy titles, and the language has no long words. I mean, this is sad, and it shows it's society and the church. We, you know, sometimes when you're explaining something to someone, and you get a blank expression, it could be that they just don't understand what you're talking about. I just don't know. But we have to dumb down some of our ideas. So this is why. You know, hopefully would be dumbed down enough, but I'm probably going to have to write Hope Part 2 for the especially thick people. This is not being filmed, is it? No. No, okay. All right. Just well, Phil's a good video editor out there. But so there's the first four. The fifth one is such a big one. It's basically just the church. Is there life in the church? Because if, let's say that anti-Semitism hadn't taken hold in the early church, and let's say that the Hebrew roots weren't jettisoned, and let's say that people kept in the Hebraic mindset, the church history would be full of life, not death. You know, the church history is no different. So many aspects of church history is like what we see with ISIS now. The way, the creative ways that Christians found to kill each other, killing other Christians, and, you know, you just read stories, and it puts anything you read about ISIS, you know, it just is, it's the same thing. Where was the life? How were people converted through love and not through the sword? You know, Jews were forced to be baptized, but they were forced at the sword, be baptized or die. Where's the love? You know, where were the words of Jesus in that? No wonder John Wycliffe was persecuted, you know, because people would have seen the real words of how we should be dealing with our brothers and sisters. So that needs to come back. Life. When I wrote this book, there were two books that I had on my bookshelf for many, many years, and I knew one day I'd have to read them. And the reason why I didn't, because they were so complicated, I knew one day I'd have to read them and actually write about them. And one was a book by a Finnish Christian theologian from the 50s, and it's every paragraph was so dense it would take like a week to really understand it, but I struggled through it, and I've got the concepts in this now, all the good ones anyway. And it's called, I've forgotten what it's called, but it's in the acknowledgements of the book. But the other one, probably more importantly, the other one, some of you might know the name Abraham Heschel, was a rabbi. He's an American rabbi from the 20th century. And he was like the chief rabbi of America during the 50s and the 60s. And he wrote a book called God in Search of Man. And that was the other book I read. And it was incredible. And I'm thinking, if that book had been, that book is how the church should have been. Apart from the fact that he obviously didn't find Jesus, because this was a secular Jewish rabbi. But the love of God for man is shown so incredibly in this book. And how we should be dealing with each other, how we should be dealing with God. So that has sort of become a center point of this book, just bringing those ideas into the church. And that's been, you know, lost the... And it, you could say Greek thinking. Now, Socrates, like the Greek philosopher, when he was thinking, and he would just stand immobile, you know, like a meerkat. And when an idea came, it got animated, but it was all stillness. The whole Greek idea is about stillness and contemplation and everything internalized. But when you see Jewish people, you know, we go to a yeshiva, you know, it's constant arguing and movement. And when you see Jews at prayer, they're not standing still, they're swaying backwards and forwards. It's all about movement. And this is life, you know, and L'chaim, life, it's my book, To Life, is what the Jewish or the Hebraic perspective is all about, bringing life back into the church. So that has been lost. The church has become, you know, when you think of how the world looks at the church, it doesn't look at a place where there's life, you know, not anymore. And we need to bring that back. So the Hebraic church should be about bringing life back into the church. Okay, so they're the first five things, and the last two are a little bit different, and these are the two things that I want to sort of concentrate on. But before I do that, just to say, let me know when I'm 5 minutes away. Okay, there's two things. The first thing is looking at the way that God deals with us through history. God tends to be a God of time, not of space. When you look at the Old Testament, God would identify himself through things that had happened. He'd identify himself as, I am the God who brought you out of Egypt. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's identifying him through times where he's interacted with humans, or, you know, prophets all through the Old Testament, just through events, one after the other, through time. Space, not so important. doesn't matter so much where people were, but it's the actual time that God actually interacted. And so if you read through the Bible, you sort of realize that it's also something about us as well. We can individualize that and realize that in our own lives, it is what's probably the most important thing for us as Christians are the times when God has met us. It's not clever arguments, you know, going to a debate of a Christian and atheist and saying, oh, I'm glad the Christian had better arguments than the atheist. Sometimes he doesn't. You know, if you get a really good atheist, you know, someone who's good at debating, he can win an argument and despite not having the truth. But God interacting with us as believers is so important. Now, there have been three major times in my life where, you know, God has interacted. One was when I became a believer. One, I suppose, was last year in that hotel room with Hebraic Church. But there was another one which was so bad. It was a terrible, it was a month of complete nightmare for me. But I came out of it and it was, I needed to have, let's say, you know, there were things I had to be taken away from me. And what was shown from that is the power of God. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. It's just something you can never, once you've been through something like that, the power of the name of Jesus, the power of God working through you, you know, and the Holy Spirit dealing with you, it's absolutely amazing. And we should seek these God moments. And this is sort of the thing that I want to say, you know, it's remember, don't analyze. As Christians, we need to put ourselves in atmospheres where God has a chance to speak to us, for us to have these moments with God, because when times are bad further down the line, these are the things that are going to keep you going. When you have doubt, it's not a good argument that's going to bring you back. It's, oh, I remember when God really spoke to me, and that was something just so real to me personally. Even testimonies are good, but they're secondhand, don't they? You know, it's, even if it's something that's happened to a friend of yours, it's still not you. You know, so we should seek to not just live with our original testimony when we are believers, but to seek a continuous testimony through God working through us. And we'd like to think, you know, through Joe's worship and hopefully what was going to happen tomorrow, which I'll talk more about later on, is that we're all going to get a chance to meet individually with God in whatever way is relevant to us. And, you know, we are corporate people, but we're all so different. You know, worship sort of, in essence, sort of means something different to all of us. You know, different worship styles would mean different things to different people, but there are other ways of worshiping. We're going to look at that tomorrow as well. Okay, so final one, the seventh one, is, I had a prop, but I've lost it. Okay. I have to pretend I've got a pencil in my hand. Right, there's an invisible pencil. It's about 3 inches long and it's sort of yellow. Yep. And if I say, describe what I've got in my hand, so someone say, well, it's 3 inches long and it's yellow. But that is the form of the pencil. But the function of the pencil is that which we use to write. And that's all that's really important. And this is something that comes out, I think, out of architecture, form and function. And it's so important because I believe this is the way that God sees us. This is the way that God deals with us. It's not about objects. It's about what you do with the objects. It's not about us individually as, you know, as you've got a certain name, you've got a social security number, you know, the government classifies you in so many different ways. But God sees us all individually as beings who he has created for a function. And it's up to us to find out what that function is and for others to try to identify it in each other. Again, this is something that tomorrow hopefully we're going to explore together. Those of us that don't quite know what our function is in the body, perhaps it's time to really think and ask God, what do you really want me to do with my life? And for others, perhaps to have the discernment to speak to people here and say, I think that you'll be very good at cleaning toilets. You know? No. I think you have the gift of prophecy. You know, so just be more spiritual. Function doesn't have to be all the big spiritual things. You know, we all crave for the spiritual gifts, but you know, gifts come in a very wide variety of forms, and there are very practical gifts that we can all do, you know, to help the body of Christ. So, we can go back biblically to see that this is how God has worked. But in a sense, when you look through the Bible, people tended to be named according to their function. You know, Israel, when Jacob fought, you know, that the angel, and his name was changed to Israel, struggles with God. I mean, what an apt name for the nation of Israel, struggles with God. You know, we are called Christians, but that doesn't mean anything. To the world out there, the name Christian has got so many negative connotations. You know, what do they see? They see the, whenever there's a Christian on a sitcom or a soap, you know that Christian's going to do something dodgy. You know that Christian's going to have a secret agenda, that Christian will be judgmental, or something strange. You know, there's never a normal Christian in a soap, because that is how the world sees us. You know, they don't trust us. And perhaps it's just a general hatred or negativity towards religion as a whole because of what they see in Islam. We get painted with the same brush. We're fundamentalists, so there must be something wrong with us. You know, we're not towing the line of the secular world. So we go through scripture and we see all the time names being used. And Jesus himself. Now, you know, the word Jesus means nothing. But if we said salvation, you know, that man is called salvation. And that's what people called him. Yeshua, you know, his true Hebrew name actually meant salvation. So you can just see how that word has so much meaning. Perhaps we shouldn't be called Christians, we should be called Jesus copiers. There you go. And of course that has the problem if you say I'm a Jesus copier and they're saying, well, why are you frowning at me then? You should be happy. So that gives us the onus to be good witnesses as well. So that maybe we should be Jesus copiers and be, you know, not hide away in our little ghettos, but be more overt. As long as we're doing a good witness, as long as we are trying to show Jesus' likeness in our lives. So that's basically it. So there are the seven things. Function, not form. It's the last one. I did have a whole load of more stuff, but you have to read the book because I think my time is virtually up. The last point that I've made in the book, which I won't make now, is it's great to do all these things, but balance is really important. There's too much imbalance, and I sort of hinted yesterday that too many in the Messianic movement has gone so Jewish. You know, the one you man is Jew and Gentile together, and we have to celebrate both separately and together and use what's best in each and find a way together as a one new man, not as a group of Gentiles pretending to be Jews. You know, I don't mean that in a negative way, but that tends to what happens on the peripheral. So I think that's given you enough introduction. You're gonna have all the real Bible teaching coming up, but at the end of the day, I'll be doing part two, where we'll be looking at the practical side of what's going to happen tomorrow, and the practical side of all the theory that I've just come out with. So we'll meet again then. So thank you all for listening. Thank you. Thank you. Right. Are they still there?
We hope you enjoyed that talk. If you want to hear any more from the Foundation 7 conference or any other Foundation conferences, then go to our website at www.foundationsconferences.com.